Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Griffin. I'm here on behalf of Frank Miller. I'd like to start with the sufficiency argument, and I'm hoping to get to my second argument, but that will depend on timing. As the court knows, the prosecution theory in this case was that Mr. Miller was guilty of murder and attempted murder as a complicit, because the evidence was undisputed that Tech, who was the backseat passenger, was the actual shooter. The prosecution had to prove, among other things, all of the required mens rea for these offenses, which is a little complicated because of complicity, but he had to prove that Mr. Miller knowingly aided or encouraged the shooting, that he had the intent, that he did that with the intent to facilitate murder and attempted murder, and that he also acted with mens rea for the underlying offenses, which includes both knowledge that the conduct he was assisting was practically certain to cause death, and that the circumstances evidenced an attitude of universal malice manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life generally. In short, my client had to know before the shots were fired that this was going to happen, that Tech, not just that he had a gun, but that he was actually going to shoot the gun at people.
Well, Ms. Griffin, I thought I read that there was testimony from one of the witnesses in the car who said that the defendant loaded the gun, handed the gun to Tech, and told him to shoot someone.
That's correct. That's AJ's testimony, and
Why wouldn't that be sufficient evidence of?
Well, I'm going to address the reason why. AJ's testimony, and it's an unusual case, AJ's testimony is not sufficient in quality to enable a rational juror to reach a subjective state of near certitude of guilt, which is the standard required by the U.S. Supreme Court in Jackson versus Virginia. It's not a scintilla of the evidence. It's not that there is some evidence and you're done. It's de novo review. And just as you do when you determine whether the prosecution has met any burden of proof, whether it's scintilla or preponderance or clear and convincing or beyond reasonable doubt, the court has to assess and determine that there's enough evidence. Not that you personally, individually, would have found Mr. Miller guilty.
So that wouldn't go to the weight of the evidence as opposed to the admissibility of the evidence?
Well, I'm not arguing that his testimony was inadmissible necessarily. What I'm arguing is that his testimony came in and yet there was not sufficient evidence. The evidence was not sufficient in its quality to permit a rational juror to find guilt proved beyond a reasonable doubt for my client to be locked up for the rest of his life. And I really want to explain why.
Okay, please.
Basically, as the prosecution argued in this case, all of the disputed elements in this case come down to what happened in the car. And as you pointed out, the only evidence of what happened in that car, aside from my client's statements, which is, I didn't know this was going to happen, I didn't hand him the gun, I had no idea he was going to shoot, were from AJ, the front seat passenger. The shooter didn't testify, and his statements were not, neither side sought to admit his statements. So this all comes down to AJ. And this is an unusual case, and I understand that the court is not inclined to say, when there's a witness testifying to the disputed elements, that the evidence is insufficient. But this is a case where that is appropriate, because there are a number of reasons, so many reasons, and unique reasons in this case, why AJ's testimony was not of the quality that we require, that due process requires, to lock someone up for the rest of their life. First of all, AJ was presumptively unreliable, and that is not my opinion, but the opinion of the United States Supreme Court, because he was in the front seat, he was being treated like a suspect, and when he made his statement, he had motives to curry favor and deflect blame, and he had an additional motive in this case, which is a kind of a strange side note. But the first thing he did when he was released from the interrogation was to text Mr. Miller's girlfriend and say, and he knew Mr. Miller had been arrested and was in custody and say, hey, I'm leaving my wife and I want to build something with you now. And then they started a relationship, which is kind of a side note, but it's also important because that's how we know that you can't say, well, gee, AJ's accusation is credible because he's Mr. Miller's friend.
But again, I guess, why wouldn't these kinds of credibility determinations go to the jury, and why wouldn't they decide that?
Well, because of the sheer number and type, and that was just the first one. And I also want to remind the court that in Jackson versus Virginia, the Supreme Court said there will be cases where a properly instructed jury will find someone guilty, even though it can be said that no rational juror could find the defendant guilty beyond reasonable doubt. In other words, the question isn't just whether there was some evidence. The evidence has to be good enough.
So is your argument then that given the various considerations you raised in your brief and that I expect you're going to be getting to now, that it's irrational for a juror to have relied upon that evidence?
Yes. It was not of sufficient quality. And the second reason, and this is one that's very unusual, is that AJ wasn't only contradicted by other witnesses and by his own many statements. He was contradicted by surveillance videos. He was contradicted by gun mechanics. And very specifically, he made very specific statements where he said, Mr. Miller dropped the clip and ejected a round from the gun as he was driving. Well, the ballistics expert said you need two hands to eject the chambered round, and AJ even agreed with that. And then what's the second problem with that? No round was ejected from the gun. And we know that because the prosecution expert said 11 or 12, but probably 11, no fewer than 11 rounds were fired from that gun. The magazine only holds 10 rounds. So for there to be 11 rounds in that gun to be fired, there was not a round ejected, because then a round would have had to be added to the magazine, and that never happened. There was no testimony about that. That's just one thing. The second thing, he said Miller reinserted the clip and jacked the round while he was turning. Well, the surveillance video shows that the car was speeding through all the turns, and the ballistics expert said you would need two hands to insert the clip. Well, AJ realizes when he's challenged on that, that that's impossible, that couldn't happen, so he changes his story. In a trial, he says, Miller reinserted the clip and jacked around while he was stopped at the red light before they turned into Walmart. Well, there's a red light camera, and what does it show? The car never stopped. He said the car stopped, and that's when Miller reloaded. So we've got very unique types of evidence that can't be disputed, that don't lie. Videos don't lie. Gun mechanics and ballistics experts don't lie about how many bullets the gun holds. She said, I tried to put more in, it only holds that many. That's how many it holds.
Well, wouldn't it be possible that AJ got those portions of the story wrong and still was accurate in his testimony that defendant was the shoot, that the defendant instigated the shooting?
Well, I suppose anything is possible, but the question is whether there was sufficient evidence for due process purposes to lock someone up for the rest of their life. And this is someone who wasn't the shooter. And this is the only evidence coming from AJ. And he's not just disputed on those points, but additional points by the video. Like he says, we slowly crept up behind these guys. And the video shows that the car was speeding. It was going faster than all the other cars. I mean, there's more of that. But then there's also the way his accusation came out. I mean, he's an admitted liar. He's a persuasive liar. He admits that he calculated ahead of time. They're going to want to talk to me. I'm going to create an alibi. I'm going to get two people to corroborate my alibi. What does he do when Peterson does bring him in and treats him like a suspect? He tells Peterson, I was never there. I've got two witnesses. Detective Peterson, experienced homicide detective, believes him. Why does he believe him? He's a good liar. And Peterson admits, I was surprised when AJ had to make this calculated admission 45 minutes in that, well, later I went back because later two people picked him up at Mr. Miller's place. Peterson's thrown off. He says, I wasn't expecting that. I thought he wasn't there. So that's when Peterson gives him an out.
Are you asking us to find AJ's testimony incredible as a matter of law?
Well, you know, that's a term that we use in Colorado, and if that's what you want to call it, that's fine. But the United States Supreme Court has said that the question isn't just whether there's some evidence, and that there are cases where a jury will convict, and that there is some evidence, but it's not good enough. This is that case. I don't think, because I think that's the law, and I think the law is that the evidence has to be both sufficient in both quantity and quality. It has to be substantial and sufficient. So I don't think you have to find him incredible as a matter of law. I think he is incredible as a matter of law because of the surveillance videos and the gun mechanics and everything else. But I don't think you have to say that. So the accusation comes out when Peterson says, here's what I think. I think it was all Miller. He went crazy. You were there, but you didn't know anything about it. In fact, I think he tried to stop it. And I'm giving you the first chance to cooperate with me because we both know I'm going to talk to Mr. Miller, and then it might get ugly, and that we don't want anyone else to go down. And hey, this ain't rocket science. It ain't rocket science, right? I mean, AJ isn't stupid. And if you look at AJ's face after Peterson tells him, here's what I want you to say, he's just stone cold again. He's just thinking, and then he says, yeah, that's what happened. Miller went crazy, and he gave the gun to Tech, and he said, shoot the first person you see. And then Peterson left the room, gave him 10 minutes to think it through and decide what he's going to say. And then he comes up with all these other details, most of which are all internally contradictory. Just quickly on the interrogation, there's two errors. They're both independently reversible errors. The first one is that the court agreed with the prosecution's request to selectively redact one interrogation tactic from the video, and that is the Detective Peterson saying, I think you're lying, would you pass the polygraph? Yeah. Even though the jury heard him said, your story is bullshit, you're lying, I play poker for a living, I can tell you're lying, I don't believe you, that's what I do for a living, you're hiding something, you're being deceitful, I know you're lying, you're definitely not telling me the truth. Even though the jury heard all of that, the court agreed to reject, you're lying, would you pass a polygraph? So, and go ahead.
So you think that People versus Muniz was incorrectly decided?
Well, first of all, I do think that. But I also think it's distinguishable because there it was the defendant either offering or agreeing to take a polygraph. This is Detective Peterson just saying, would you pass a polygraph? And Mr. Miller saying, yeah. But yes, I think it's incorrect because this idea that it's almost like a taboo, like there's a per se rule that no matter what happens, no one can ever say the word polygraph in a criminal trial. That's clearly not correct. And if you look at the Mann case from our Supreme Court, which was out, you know, at the time of this trial, that makes it clear that under the rule of completeness, sometimes it's just going to be admissible. In that case, the interrogator testified that during the interrogation, the defendant said, well, I'm not willing to take a polygraph, though. And the Supreme Court not only said it wasn't reversible error, they said, that was fine, we agree, that was proper. So this idea that there's a per se inadmissibility rule is just incorrect. And the circumstances of the interrogation are important, and it's part of the defendant's right to present a defense, to present the circumstances, because the jury's assessment of my client's statement and AJ's statement, that's what this whole case was about. And they asked to watch both of those statements during deliberations. I'm going to save my 40 seconds for a vote.
Thank you.
Good May please the court. I'm Jay Fisher. I represent the people on this matter, registration number 44350. The problem with the defendant's evidence sufficiency argument is that the state did have A.J. Nelson as a witness, and while it's true that he was an uncharged co-defendant, that status went to his credibility and not his competency to testify. At trial, A.J. Nelson's status was brought forth to the jurors. They were told that, in fact, he was an uncharged co-defendant. They were also informed that he'd been granted limited use immunity. They were also informed that the prosecution did not charge him, and they were also informed that if he did not provide testimony in the case, that he would be prosecuted. All that information was brought forth to the jurors, and when they were allowed to assess his credibility based upon that. It's not this court's job to reweigh the evidence. The jury is the sole judge of the witness credibility. Furthermore, A.J.'s testimony was not so incredible as to violate the laws of nature. He had testified that it was the defendant's plan, and that fact is backed up by the evidence that, in fact, the shooting did happen in the defendant's car and with the defendant's gun. He also testified about the defendant providing the gun, and that fact is backed up by the defendant's own admission that the gun used in the shooting was his own. AJ also testified that the car had slowed down prior to shooting the victims in this case. That evidence is backed up by the victims themselves, who said, "We heard nothing coming from behind us." There's been some dispute from the defendant that, in fact, that the car was accelerating, but again, the victim said, "We didn't hear a thing."
Excuse me, counsel. Ms. Griffin has pointed out a discrepancy in the testimony about how many rounds the gun could hold. Does that make a difference? You're pointing out that the defendant admitted that it was his gun that was used.
Correct, but it doesn't matter because, again, that goes to the weight of the evidence and not necessarily to its admissibility. That is a fact for the jury to take into deliberations and when they're assessing the case. And if they decided, in fact, that maybe AJ was mistaken on this point, or there's another explanation, or that maybe it was just a misperception about how many rounds were fired, they're the people who ultimately decide the facts in this matter, and they decide it against the defendant.
May I just follow up for one moment, please, Mr. Fisher? You say that, and I understand that it's not our job to determine credibility, but applying the test of whether there's substantial and sufficient, don't we to some extent have to do some weighing of the evidence
of course
apply that test?
Of course. I mean, it is de novo review, but again, there's this other aspect of it as well that hasn't been mentioned yet. It's in a light most favorable to the prosecution, and so you have to assess that as well. And again, all the facts that were brought forth were in fact brought forth at the trial, and the defendant was allowed to argue those during the progress of the case, and ultimately the jury decided it against him. The last point I'd like to raise up about AJ's testimony not being so incredible is the additional point that AJ Nelson had testified that the car sped off after the shooting. And again, that was also backed up by the surviving victim in this matter as well. And there's a reasonable inference from this that, in fact, this was part of the defendant's plan. Shoot these people, speed off, get away. Now, regarding the issue of the testimony that was in one case redacted and another point admitted, regarding the polygraph, there's a reason why we don't have polygraph evidence in this case, and it's also considered per se inadmissible. Because it's scientifically unreliable. We just don't open the door to that type of information. It would lead to sideshows happening during trials regarding whether polygraphs are in fact accurate, and specifically in this case.
Well, the results are unreliable.
The results, correct.
But the offer, why couldn't that be consciousness of innocence or something like that?
It's because of the way the defendant had framed it in this case. He was trying to say, I wanted to present my offer to take a polygraph to show that I was consistent throughout my story. That I said A, and I was willing to take a polygraph, and on the other side of it, if it had in fact been given, my story would still say A. In other words, it was completely self-serving. And the problem is that in certain instances, self-serving testimony is admissible, but it still has to be corroborated. You can't corroborate in this case. No polygraph was given. Thus, it was prejudicial to the prosecution, and it was inadmissible accordingly. Furthermore, there's the whole issue of prejudice when the word polygraph is put into a trial and you're dealing with citizen jurors, because again, polygraph is one of these loaded words. It's a word that a lot of people know and they have a lot of misconceptions about. People may know what a polygraph is, but they may not know the scientific problems behind it. Consequently, we don't want to taint jurors in a case by trying to infuse this kind of material in a trial, so we just exclude it. Now, regarding the issue of the detective statements about not believing Mr. Miller during the interrogation, first of all, those statements were admissible. Davis says it, Lopez says it, those kind of statements are admissible when offered to provide context for the detective's interrogation tactics and investigation techniques. There's been an issue regarding whether there should have been a limiting instruction given regarding this. First of all, the limiting instruction that the defendant provided was poorly worded. The trial court had no obligation to provide that particular limiting instruction. And then there's the whole issue of, in fact, that the defendant got a limiting instruction at the end of the case. And it, again, this wasn't a perfect limiting instruction, but it was better than the one the defendant provided. And it was better because if you look at the wording of it, it said, however, a police officer's opinion about the believability of the interviewee is simply an interrogation technique among others employed by law enforcement. This is better because what it says is every time the detective said, I don't believe you, it was simply an interrogation technique. That would even apply to his testimony that was brought forth in cross-examination about not believing the defendant in this case. So ultimately, in the end, he got the limiting instruction that he wanted, or that he desired, I should say, and there was no error in admitting this testimony under Davis and Lopez. And this court has no further question.
Actually, I do have a further question. You said something about the word polygraph being a loaded word to a jury. And so are gang references, right? And
correct.
We had in here the judge telling the parties and admonishing them that they were not to use the term bloods.
Correct.
During the trial. And yet, the prosecutor at one point asked the witness, what does that mean, get down? He said, to be initiated into the gang. He said, what gang? And he said, bloods.
Correct.
So, why isn't that prejudicial to the point of being reversible in this case, particularly given the admonishment by the trial judge not to do that very thing?
Correct. It's because of the subsequent remedial actions that were taken. The prosecutor immediately went to great lengths to try and correct the problem once it arose. Furthermore, there was an extensive amount of side conference information about what happened, and it was clear that the prosecutor had admonished the witnesses, had provided them with detailed instructions as to what happened, and told them, don't say this. In other words, if you're going to say anything about this particular subject, it was supposed to be in accordance with the trial court's instruction, which was the gang of Frank or the Miller gang. So again, it was nothing on the prosecutor's part, and nothing's been shown that it was bad faith on the prosecutor's part that this error arose. Consequently, there was no basis for a mistrial as the defendant had requested in this particular instance. And again, the prosecution went to great lengths to try to correct this error when it occurred. Okay. And if this court has no further questions, we'd ask that you affirm the convictions as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just regarding that last question, if the prosecution had wanted to go to great lengths to avoid that prejudice, they ought to have agreed with what the defense requested, if not a mistrial, then for the judge to tell the jury, Mr. Miller is not in an organized gang and he is not in the Bloods. but they did not go along with that. The instruction that the court offered was, please disregard what you've heard about the Bloods, and the defense not unreasonably decided that would just make it look like they were hiding the fact that their client was in this gang. I thank the court for its attention and ask you to reverse the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank both counsel for your arguments, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.